It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Let's see, what is it? I think it's Tuesday morning, July. I should have looked this up before I got on the air here, but I didn't. July the 14th, it's Bastille Day. That's what I should have remembered that, too. Boy, I'm off to a rough start so far. But anyway, good morning, Vermont, and I'm glad you could join us here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. We have got a good show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be speaking with Senator Michael Sorotkin in just a couple minutes to talk with him about legislation just signed into law yesterday by Governor Phil Scott relating to workers' compensation coverage for coronavirus, folks who come down with the coronavirus, especially if they can provide some indication that might have happened at work. That's been a bit of a debate, and they just signed that bill into law yesterday, or the governor did, I should say. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Ralph Corbo, the 9:30 to 10 block. He's going to be joining us to talk about his candidacy for Congress. He's a Democrat looking to unseat Peter Welch in the Democratic primary upcoming on August the 11th. And then in the latter hour of the show, I actually went on Facebook the other day and I said, hey, folks, who's got suggestions for topics and guests on the program? And several people responded saying we should have a discussion here, sort of an update. We have talked about this before, but an update on how things are going with this new law that took effect July 1st in Vermont, that no more food scraps in the landfill. Apparently, there's a lot of people out there composting now because that seems to be the way to go. And in many areas, others are signing up for composting services where your food scraps get picked up. And we're going to be talking about all of that with Josh Kelly of the Department of Environmental Conservation in the latter hour of the program this morning. But I wanted to start off just by mentioning a couple of interesting news stories. We may try to get some guests on later this week to talk about this debate over adding new portable bathrooms in Montpelier. And this is a really common thing in a lot of our communities around Vermont and around America right now, where businesses have shut down and even some public facilities have very restricted hours, libraries, city hall, et cetera, in Montpelier and elsewhere. And that has really limited access to bathrooms for folks, for visitors to the city, for the homeless population, for others who would just need the facilities. And so there's concern about this. Montpelier has added a couple of the portable bathrooms around the city. There's talk of adding more, and that is a big story on the front page of the Times Argus this morning. Department of Corrections is changing its healthcare provider following the death of an inmate there. There's always questions about whether medical care was adequate, or not always, but in many of these cases where inmates pass away in the facilities in Vermont or in the facilities Vermont contracts with out of state, did that inmate really need to die then, or was it a result of less than great medical care for these folks? So that's just another of the topics being covered in the Vermont media this morning. Let's go first, though, to this discussion of this bill that was just signed into law yesterday by Governor Phil Scott. I have as a guest on the phone this morning Senator Michael Sorotkin, a key sponsor of that legislation. He's a Democrat from Chittenden County. And Senator Michael Sorotkin, thank you very much for joining me.
Morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Glad to do it. So tell us about what this bill does and how it was decided there was a need for it.
Well, basic premise of the bill that most people are talking about is it shifts the burden of proof from the employee to show that their illness, their COVID illness, was contracted at work. But before I get into that, let me just say there's a much overlooked portion of the bill that really was the start of the bill itself. When we went, we left the State House on March 13th, and we started meeting on Zoom all the way through June until we took our temporary break that we're on now. And the President Pro Tem of the Senate, Tim Ash, basically said everything we worked on from March 13th for the first like 6 weeks we're on Zoom had to be COVID-related and COVID response-related. And as you know, we did a lot with the unemployment insurance system, made it easier for people to get on unemployment if they feared they would contract COVID when they went in. We changed a lot of municipal laws about meeting requirements so that municipal government could still function. We changed requirements for healthcare professionals so we can have the greatest possible access for our healthcare professionals, all these temporary fixes. And in my committee, we worked on the unemployment insurance thing a lot, but then we also turned our attention to workers' compensation. Workers' compensation, for the listeners that don't know, is when you contract an injury or an illness on the job, you get two-thirds of your wage replaced generally, plus you get all your medical benefits covered, you get vocational rehabilitation benefits, and in some cases, God forbid, you get death benefits for your family. So what we were hearing was that people who had been on workers' compensation, the system was such that they could cut off from their workers' compensation by an employer simply filing a form, which is called the Form 27, saying that the employer felt that the injury had healed and the person was able to return to work. The employee has a right to present countervailing evidence to keep their benefits going, but during COVID, they had very little access to their doctors, or the doctors were shut down or too busy, couldn't get their information. So the first part of this bill was to give the Commissioner of Labor extraordinary powers to be more flexible to comport with the remedial nature of the workers' compensation law so that they can get worker can get more time to make their case. That was the first time. As we got into that, we started hearing about COVID-19 cases where people were contracting and filing a claim for COVID-19. So let me just jump into the heart of the bill, and that is that when you think of COVID-19 and we have all these tracing things going on, it's really difficult to determine from one aspect, one side or the other, whether the person has contracted COVID-19 at work or at home or in, to a greater degree now, in social settings as we open up our public offerings right now. So we have had experience in the past where, by law, let me just back up, workers' compensation again, the injury has to be work-related. That is, it has to be caused or contracted on the job or in the workplace. And the burden is on the employee to show that the injury, in this case COVID-19, happened at work. Now, if you have a slip and fall on the factory floor, it's pretty easy to show that it happened at work. When you start dealing with infectious diseases such as this, it's almost next to impossible to determine when and where that disease was contracted. So given that workers' comp is a remedial statute that's supposed to help injured workers, some laws have been passed, such with PTSD. We passed a law a few years ago that mental health diseases or PTSD, if that happened with a first responder, like a firefighter or an ambulance driver or a police worker, that the presumption is that it was contracted on the job, and it would be up to the employer to rebut that presumption. And that's essentially what we did here. So that's the heart of the bill. It's a pretty short, simple bill, but it's really important to the number of cases which we're hearing is, you know, about 125 now of people who have contracted COVID-19 and have put in for a workers' comp claim.
Do you know, there must be a lot more in other states because there are a lot more cases of the COVID-19 in other states. And around the country, quite a number of healthcare workers have died of the COVID-19 after, you know, working long hours in just what sound like pretty hellish conditions in, you know, hospital intensive care units and so on and so forth. What do you know about what's happening in other states on this, if anything?
I know pretty much what you just said there, but to bring it back to our bill, part of the we're not alone here. At the time this bill went through the Senate, which was about 6 or 8 weeks ago, we had heard that there were about 13 states that had already passed similar legislation to Vermont. So people are aware of it, they're sensitive to it, and they're trying to address the problem.
Yeah, the I certainly get why folks would want coverage in this kind of a case. I remember years ago there was a special workers' comp sort of carve out related to a sick building down in Bennington. Do you remember that case? It was a state building in Bennington. You were around in the Senate back then, weren't you, or around the State House?
I was around the State House. I don't know if I was in the Senate yet, but I certainly do remember the case. And I don't know exactly whether it was a lawless. I know there was benefits paid to or compensation paid to the workers there. I don't know whether it was through the workers' compensation system or not.
This is a tough thing. I know that in a lot of cases in the sort of routine workers' comp world, many times the workers' comp insurance company will hire, you know, they have these consulting physicians, and you go for a physical or some kind of an evaluation if you're filing a workers' comp claim, and you know, and they can challenge the employee. You know, you didn't get that repetitive strain injury from work. You got it from playing tennis or something. I mean, that's sort of a somewhat apocryphal kind of a case, but it's the sort of thing that often happens in this back and forth over workers' comp, and I can imagine, you know, workers' comp insurers who are obviously trying to limit their payouts. Saying something about, well, are we 100% certain that you got the COVID-19 that you're dealing with at work? The Burlington Free Press had a story about someone who worked in one of the Burlington nursing homes where there was a big outbreak of the COVID cases. This employee developed COVID-19 and ended up having to be essentially. That was a case that sort of brought this to a head, right, in this whole issue?
Well, it's certainly representative of the issue we faced with this bill. Again, it comes down to the issue of burden of proof. It's very hard for either side to definitively say where the disease was contracted. But in certain professions, like the frontline workers, professions that we outlined in this bill, it's pretty likely that it was caught on the job. So you start with the presumption, that's what this bill says, that if you're a frontline worker and you've contracted COVID-19, it is presumed that you caught it on the job. That does not mean the employer doesn't have a right to come back and say, oh, well, this person was really not in the course of his employment, never really got exposed to anybody, and we know for a fact back home he has two people in his household that also has COVID-19. So they can rebut it. But having the presumption in favor of the worker is a big deal because in many of these cases, you just don't know.
The workers' comp is one of these percolating issues that you followed for years because you're a longtime advocate for working people in Vermont. And I think you were actually, prior to your time in the Senate, you were a lobbyist for various labor organizations. Do I recall that correctly?
That's correct, yes.
And so you've been following these kinds of issues for quite a while. Do you think that Vermont is by and large treating workers fairly on this front these days, or does it need to do more? Does workers' comp need to be more generous, or is it gone too far? Is it being too generous toward workers? Where does Vermont rank sort of among the states in terms of its requirements for workers' comp insurance to pay out and pay out reasonably generously?
I think we do fairly well. I know when I was working on behalf of working families, we were able to get our weekly maximum more reflective of modern times. A lot of workers' compensation systems around the country have very limited maximum benefits, so middle-income people get capped out and don't get two-thirds of their of their average weekly pay when they're out for work. We have a fairly good maximum cap, so that's really good. I think it's a pretty sound system, and I'm pleased that in the last few years, I don't know how far back we would go, but our workers' comp rates have gone down significantly, and that's, I think, a result of the good work of people representing labor, people management, and state government, and the way to keep, the primary way to keep rates down for employers is through better safety measures on the job. So you avoid the injury to begin with, and we've done a fairly good job of that over the last decade.
All right. Let's take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. We'll continue our conversation with Senator Michael Sorotkin on the other side.
You know that carnival shell game with the three cups? The ball goes under one, then there's the quick shuffle, the fast-talking chatter, and all the while you're supposed to keep your eye on the ball. This is Mitchell Jay. Here at Midstate Dodge, we don't play any of these games. Your experience will be fast, easy, and transparent. Fast means you can find all of our vehicles online with the shopping tools to help you quickly narrow your search to the vehicle that best suits your needs. Easy means you can start the purchase online, and once you're at the dealership, our experienced sales professionals are ready to quickly guide you through the rest of the sales process. Transparent means we show you exactly what you're paying for from the moment you initiate your purchase until you own your car. No last-minute surprise, it's all up front. Come compare our prices with any other deal. You'll find we make it easy. Midstate Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram Hyundai on the Barry Montpelier Road or online at MidstateDodge.com.
At Midstate Dodge, we make it easy. We make it easy.
I got started in the antiques business as a kid. I grew up in the trade.
Brian Bittner of Bittner Antiques in Shelburne.
My grandfather was an auctioneer in southern Vermont in Brattleboro, and he sold woodworking tools and then moved right into general antique estates. My dad did the business as a hobby, and I grew up going to yard sales, going to flea markets, being a runner for my grandfather's auctions when I was 8 years old. I remember one of the first things I ever bought was at one of his auctions, and I bought a box lot of books. I was working the sale, so my aunt bid for me, and I won it. And towards the end of the sale, I was sitting in the aisle selling the books that I had just bought. I got told by Grandpa and Dad that I shouldn't be doing that. But I made a profit.
Bittner Antiques in Shelburne. When you need help with downsizing, estate planning, selling a few items, written professional appraisals, or other antiques-related consulting services, call 272-7527. Online at BittnerAntiques.com.
Attention Chevy shoppers. At the new Lamoille Valley Chevrolet, business has been awesome, right, Pat?
That's right, Dan. And in July, we've set a goal to have our best month ever here at Lamoille Valley Chevy. With that said, the Big Dog Daddy year-end clearance sale is now underway at Lamoille Valley Chevy. Folks, I want you to know that a few months ago when all the factories were closed, back here at Lamoille Valley Chevrolet, we sprang into action and bought over 150 Chevy trucks, cars, and SUVs from other dealers as far away as California. Now, while many dealer lots are getting bare, at Lamoille Valley Chevy, we have a lot full of the finest inventories of cars, trucks, and SUVs we've ever had to offer you. And in order to have a record month in July, my Lamoille Valley Chevy team and I are going to make crazy deals all month to earn your business. So come take advantage of the amazing deals from Chevrolet and our huge inventory of vehicles right now at Lamoille Valley Chevy.
Thanks, bro. So get to the Big Dog Daddy year-end clearance sale happening now at Lamoille Valley Chevrolet, just past Stowe and Mooresville in beautiful Hyde Park, Vermont.
News Radio, WDEV, FM, and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're back, and my guest is Senator Michael Sorotkin, and he is a key sponsor of a bill signed into law by Governor Phil Scott yesterday that shifts the burden of proof in workers' comp cases from the employee to the employer slash workers' comp insurance company in cases where employees are reporting that they have contracted the COVID-19 virus and disease on the job, basically. And let's go to a listener who's calling in. Sam from Williston's on the line. Good morning, Sam.
Hi, good morning. As far as the workman's comp go, an issue we have out here is an aging workforce. I believe if we had a pool, so each company doesn't have to own situations where, say, you hire an older person who, especially in the trades, that has developed, say, arthritis or something of that nature because of the type of work you're in, that it's a shared responsibility for that person's work, his lifetime work, instead of putting it on to the tag, you're the last guy that hired that person. And we share that responsibility. That way, we can probably keep older people in the workforce a little longer and make it easier on the employer and spread that workers' comp out in that scenario. And the other thing is you're talking about the reducing of the workman's comp because of safety. Well, when you go to bid this work, it doesn't really come up in the work that shows your safety and that you're the one that is kind of pushing that scale down. Everybody does put in their EMRs and things of that nature, but that really is only one reflection of you are really doing a service to your employee, keeping them safe. I think there should be other ways to reflect that in a bid that maybe could be done through legislation.
Well, I was going to ask Senator Sorokin about this, and Sam, maybe you have some thoughts too, but I was just looking at a story I think VT Digger posted a while back indicating that Vermont's workers' comp claims have been way down and rates have been way down because rates obviously are based on claims from year to year. And it seems like that all points to safer work environments and basically better performance all around on this. Am I right on that?
Or less work.
Or less work, yeah. I suppose there's well, that possibility. Senator Sorokin, you mentioned that there's been a decline in claims in recent years. What do you know about all this?
Well, I think it is directly related to reduced amounts of claims, and workers' comp rates are based upon payroll that you have at any individual employer, and therefore, if there is a safe workplace and you have an experience rating that is low, then your rates will go down on an individual basis. In response to the caller's question, there is in this legislation, the House did add a requirement that we study looking at the potential of pooling some of these risks like COVID-19 situations. So that's going to be looked at, and we continue to look at things that will try and make for safer workplaces and reduced costs. The rates have come down, and, workers' comp, people tend to forget, is part of what they call the grand bargain between employers and employees, where the employee gives up their right to sue for something like this if they can prove that an injury took place on the job in exchange for a no-fault system where, regardless of who caused the injury at work, there is a limited amount of benefits that the worker can receive. And it was established in 1915. I think it exists in every state in the country, and it's worked well for both employers and employees.
It has, to one aspect, is a lot better than insurance companies picking up an individual. But once again, there is an older workforce. Do you know what the multiplier is now in the state?
I do not.
Okay. I'm not sure either. And I know we were one of the highest, and I believe they did change the multiplier, which would affect everybody's rate also. If it does show that it's lessened because of safety scenarios. But we have had some pretty tragic incidents in this state in the last few years also. So not that that it was caused by an employer or not. I'm just saying, I think we can do much better than we do. One death is one too many.
That's for sure. Sam, I got to go, but thank you for the call. That's you make some good points there and good questions as well. So stay in touch. Well, Senator Michael Sorokin, this is an interesting topic for sure, and I think it really matters to people, working people in Vermont, if they have that kind of security. And obviously, certainly if somebody does get sick or were hurt on the job, and this is a crucial issue. So I appreciate you coming on the program this morning and talking with us about it. We are about out of time, however, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate the invite.
All righty. We are going to go to a bottom of the hour break with some CBS News here on the Dave Graham Show. We'll hear a couple words from our sponsors, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Ralph Corbo, a Democratic candidate for Congress. Stay with us, folks.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thanks for staying with us into the second half hour of our program on this Tuesday, July the 14th, 2020. And I've been trying to organize a sort of informal sampling of some of the candidates running for office in the state. I don't know if I'll get them all on before the primary, but there are many, many candidates on the list that provided by the Secretary of State's office. And I'm just focusing on statewide, so I won't get to all the legislative races for sure. But wanted to invite on this morning a man from East Wallingford who is apparently running for both governor and for the U.S. House. He's a Democrat in the U.S. House primary. Would be up against a longtime incumbent Democrat Peter Welch, and we're going to chat with Ralph Corbo about exactly what he would have planned for if he were to win either of these offices, Congress and governor. I believe he's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Mr. Carbo.
Good morning.
And first off, I have to ask you, wasn't there a player for the Red Sox named Bernie Carbo at one point?
Yeah, I got to know more about him through my friend Bill Spaceman Lee.
Uh-huh.
I worked with on his governor's campaign in 2016.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, that's how he refers to me as, because he can't remember that it's Corbo. He calls me Carbo.
Okay.
That's his old teammate on the Boston Red Sox.
Well, that may be my mistake as well. Billy and I have that in common, I apologize. Corbo.
Yeah, so dude, it's just a difference of one letter. I think it's kind of unique.
And it's easy if you're just kind of glancing at the tiny print on the long list at the Secretary of State's website.
Yeah.
To think it's Carbo, it's Corbo.
Or maybe I'll get some votes if some people think I'm the ex-Red Sox Bernie Carbo.
There you go. He had some heroic moments, I remember, back in, I don't know, it was like the 70s or something.
He also had a lot of trials and tribulations, too.
Well, there was well,
his personal story.
We won't go into those, but Corbo it is, C-O-R-B-O. You live in East Wallingford, and right. I think when we spoke on the phone a while back, you were telling me that you are a retired U.S. postal worker, is that right?
Right, yeah, I was fired because I stood up for labor rights.
Oh, okay. And so maybe you didn't intend on retiring then.
No, I would have been still working there if it wasn't that they were trying to impose retroactive rules on us years after we were hired under separate rules.
I see. Wow. And where were you working for the Postal Service?
Rutland.
Okay. In Rutland City?
Yeah, Rutland itself. It has one large facility.
Okay. And were you delivering mail or working in?
Yes.
Okay. When did you get done there? When did this firing happen?
They fired me in April of 2019.
Okay. Have you been working since then?
No, I wound up having to file for Social Security eventually because, especially now in the current situation, it's difficult to find any employment anyway.
That is for sure. The COVID-19 crisis has definitely upended our economy. And do you mind if I ask how old you are, Mr. Corbo?
62.
You're 62. Okay. And so you are eligible for to apply for Social Security then. It's 62 is the minimum age.
That's the minimum age.
Yep. And so you decided, though, that you'd see if you could find a new job. And one job you're applying for is governor of Vermont, and another one is U.S. congressman. from Vermont. And first off, let me ask you, and I think this question would have to go to a few other candidates too, who filed for multiple offices. And you're a Democrat, but how would you imagine if people elected you to both of these jobs somehow? I don't think you expect that's going to happen, but or tell me, you don't expect that's going to happen, do you?
No, I think realistically, a lot of us who are not quote unquote in the political establishment of the state know that this is basically a vehicle, particularly whatever party you choose to get across messages that establishment candidates don't want to talk about because they're too worried about how it affects their electability.
Yeah. Okay. So, but imagine, let's just play this out for a moment. Imagine you won both of these jobs. How would you do that? You know, Congress.
Well, you'd have to choose, according to the Vermont state rules of Secretary of State, you have to make a decision then of which one you would take, and the other one then would have to be re-election, I think, on the other one.
Huh, okay. Well, all right. So the point here really is more to get some messages out that you wanted to convey, which you don't believe the mainstream candidates are really talking about. Is that my own?
Right. Okay. Yeah, well, that's the case.
And all right. So give me
one person's experience on their own.
Yeah. Give me a sample or two. What are the key messages you want to convey as you pursue these candidacies?
Well, when it comes to Vermont itself, we're really got a messed up sense of priorities here. I mean, going back to one of the great governors, Dean Davis, who knew that the one of the greatest assets of Vermont was its natural environment and the mission to keep it pure and unadulterated. There's been a lack of trying to a lack of trying to take care of the environment here with things that are happening to it, like lake pollutions and air quality and things like that. I've seen many many instances of attempts, especially by this current administration, to thwart any tries of pushing through environmental legislation.
You know, there's been a fairly thorough or deep effort to do some rewriting on Act 250, the land use control law that passed under Dean Davis about 50 years ago. In the legislature, in other words, a commission that actually held hearings around the state, and then there's been extensive hearings in the House and Senate Natural Resources Committees. They haven't quite gotten a bill across the finish line yet, but we've discussed it once or twice here on the Dave Graham Show recently. And I want to, in fact, I think we did for like 2 days in a row a couple weeks ago. This comes back to me now. Anyway, did you get involved in any of those discussions? Because it seems like if environmental protection is a key concern of yours, that you would have been at those hearings, for instance.
Yeah, they held a public symposium in the House Center in Rutland to get, I guess, citizen input about almost 2 years ago that I went to. It was a big thing where we broke up into topic discussion groups and put forth our ideas. Then we had to write them down and hand them in to people. I believe it was being run basically by the, I believe it was the Agency of Natural Resources or the other agency that's concerned with Vermont's environment, and so got to put some input in there as mm-hmm. far as that went.
Yeah, and do you recall which of the topic areas you were assigned to?
We basically talked about Vermont farming, I think, in its future, where. We talked about the declining dairy industry and the effects it has particularly on greenhouse gases and methane, and that it really was becoming an obsolete industry in a sense. Only I think it only generates like 1.4% of Vermont's gross domestic product, and yet it's. It always seems to have this big influence when it comes to politics and the way it's legislated.
You're speaking about the agriculture, farming in general.
The dairy industry itself.
I see. Okay. Yeah.
Large scale dairy industry, which is a major problem when it comes to pollution in Vermont, especially lakes and waterways.
Well, what would you do if elected to Congress in terms of trying to improve the dairy industry and its impact on the environment?
Well, one of the major policies that I've talked about is there needs to be a full scale transition out of dairy into organic produce production. Of course, to do this, you can't just get by on the meager state funds that are around now. You need considerable federal funds. And one of the things to get to that point is another thing that nobody wants to talk about. We need to attack the screwed up priorities in Washington, D.C., which is a $740 billion wasteful defense budget that basically goes to fund the personal coffers of all the defense armory corporations. We need to attack that to get at least a 50% reduction in the Defense Department budget, and then you would have the funds to do all these progressive type of programs that would alleviate all kinds of environmental problems that not only destroy the physical environment but sicken people and even cause them to die.
Are you a supporter or an opponent of basing the F-35 fighter jets at the Burlington International Airport?
I'm an opponent because it's another example of a sellout to Lockheed Martin. All it is a $78 million each plane that goes for a set. You have to pay $78 million for it to Lockheed Martin, and all it is a way to fatten the coffers of Lockheed Martin and for congressmen that are in bed with them to curry favor with them for future election campaign contributions. That's so all it basically is. People can't see that, are pretty myopic.
So if you were in either office, Congress or governor, that these offices you're running for, you would actively work to ask the F-35s to be taken elsewhere.
Right. Not even to be taken elsewhere, to end the program. It's been proven that it had a lot of flawed designs. There were two crashes. Luckily, neither of the pilots got killed back in May. One in Florida at the Elgin Air Base, and another one in Canada. So already there's already a history of two crashes, not to mention all the crashes it had in experimental flights before that. So
let's talk about some of the other areas where federal and state policy either sort of work together or work in opposition sometimes, et cetera. And one of those areas is immigration. There's been quite an extensive debate between the Trump administration and some states, including Vermont to some extent, about the degree to which Vermont's state and local law enforcement should be involved in essentially aiding, helping ICE and immigration authorities to try to capture and deport people who are in the country illegally. Do you support those efforts, or do you think that Vermont ought to say we're not interested in helping and we want to? We want to keep our law enforcement efforts separate from what's going on federally.
Yes, I think you don't need these agencies that were created out of the hysteria of the Homeland Security creation that has now become again another money making industry of all these hirings and equipment production and stuff and such. We could hire from within our own state to give employment to people, and it could be done through the offices of the Vermont State Police to guard borders, and also the hiring of local county sheriffs when it becomes a problem of maybe some sort of illegal activities taking place, like in maybe in the area of drugs or something like that. But other than that, agencies like ICE, which have done inflicted a lot of harm to detainees in custody, and is just again another money making federal government project, has no place here in Vermont.
You mentioned drugs, and I'm wondering your thoughts about drug policy. Should marijuana be illegal, or should it be as it is federally, or should it be sold in stores as a, you know, similar to, say, alcohol, or where do you come down on that?
Yeah, I think marijuana has to be legalized. I think the whole approach that the country has always taken with drugs has been very puritanical in the sense that they had programs in Great Britain back in the 70s, especially for the very severe case, which is heroin addiction, where they doctors were able to prescribe heroin and then the drug to, I believe, which is methadone, to try to wean them off it. So they were able; they didn't have to worry about committing crimes to further a habit. They were able to get prescriptions for this under a doctor's care. The U.S. then, under I believe it was under the Nixon administration, put pressure on England that I can't remember what the reasoning was. The program was ended, and then their problem with drug-related crime skyrocketed. But when they were in when they had a progressive program to help severe drug addicts, they were having good results. And this is one of the many things that the puritanical thinking of decades of U.S. Type of legislation on this we need to change if we ever want to see a long-term goal of helping addicts and also eradicating drug problems.
I wondered, recently there was some discussion about the federal government at least pushing by Secretary Betsy DeVos of the Department of Education, President also saying that perhaps federal funding should be cut off for schools which decline to reopen in the fall due to worries about the COVID-19 virus. What did you think about that? Those statements from President Trump and Secretary DeVos.
No, basically, I think ways to put political pressure on maybe certain elections and the voting public, in a sense, to make them think if someone, one of the governors of a particular state, is suggesting this, that they'll lose funding and such like that. I think if you're going to have some sort of basic policy on this, you should be allowed to even have decide to keep schools closed to the end of this year and see how the some of this theory about how the startup of the fall weather might re-trigger a resurgence. We're in a situation where we can't see the forest for the trees. We're in the middle of the situation. Until you can get the perspective of time behind on something like this, you can't really know when you're in the middle of this how these things are going to play out. So a little bit of caution, I think, on that side would be warranted in terms of school reopenings and the reopenings of large athletic spectator facilities would probably be a prudent thing to do, at least until the end of the year. So, and I think someone like a president trying to put pressure to for a state, a particular state, to change that policy is pretty politically partisan and just kind of selfish in a way.
One thing that struck me was that there are obviously different impacts right now of the COVID-19. Virus, it's surging in Florida, Texas, Arizona. It seems to be pretty well under control in Vermont. Could you imagine a situation in which Vermont might say, you know, we have it enough under control that we can reopen schools in the fall, at least to some extent? Arizona might say, on the other hand, you know, it's so out of control here that we are going to do all online learning in the fall. Do you think that it is a situation that should be left to individual states, or do you like the idea of a blanket national policy coming down from Washington?
Yeah, I think it should be left in individual states. I mean, every state's situation is different. I mean, look, Vermont, with a population of under 700,000, is much different when it comes to the closeness and of population that affects other states so drastically, like New York. Each state has a different situation in terms of the demographics of their population. What they found in general recently is no matter what the demographics of a state, the resurgences, whether they're little or large, have taken place where a lot of public gathering places in close indoors, like bars and I can't remember what the other type was. Bars and restaurants, unfortunately, have seem to have been the trigger for this. And again, as I said, when you're in the middle of something like this where you haven't had a chance to step back and have any kind of perspective of time, sometimes you have to err a little bit on caution with sometimes maybe not going full scale on that. I mean, you could allow the bars and the restaurants to have their own autonomy, but I think people would then have to be given a lot of advice on it and have to use a lot of their common sense to know that, and given the information that where there have been resurgences have been sometimes under the conditions of regathering in places like this. So it's a tough thing, like I said, again, to think. But I think public institutions that are actually part of the state and especially take state funds like schools should err on the prudent side, like I said, and maybe hold off any kind of opening until the end of the year passes, just to play safe.
What do you think in general of Governor Phil Scott's handling of the coronavirus pandemic so far?
I think it's very counterproductive and short-sighted in the sense that he has never been a friend of the environment, and that's a very big play a very big role in the future of how COVID-19 is possibly kept from re-erupting. I mean, you have laws that are sitting in the House Committee on Natural Resources, Fish and Wildlife right now that would have a big impact on preventing the future spread of COVID-19. And yet he's never been an advocate, number one, the environment, and so he's never been an advocate of these.
Ralph Corbo, I hate to do it, but we are about out of time, actually, for this segment on the Dave Graham Show. Thank you very much for joining me this morning. We got to go to top of the hour CBS News.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren Store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow 3 people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into our second hour on this Tuesday morning, July the 14th, 2020. We like to go to one of our national correspondents after the top of the hour and get a little bit of perspective on what's going on around the rest of the country. And boy, there's a lot of coronavirus going around in the rest of the country. We're going to talk about that with Peter King in from CBS, who is actually sort of in Corona Central down there in Orlando, Florida, I do believe. Is that right, Peter?
Yes, and good morning, although the epicenter here in Florida is much further south in Miami-Dade County.
I heard a CBS interview actually this morning with an official down there. I don't recall which one, but who was saying that basically Miami is about where Wuhan was 6 months ago.
Yeah, and that was the county's infectious disease specialist. And, you know, the positive test rate down there has averaged about 23% for the past 2 weeks. It was up to almost 30% yesterday. This is not good. And while South Florida has always been the leader in number of cases here in Florida, it's just gotten progressively worse over the past few weeks.
And is there any sense that that there is a sort of an arc to this thing, that it eventually will peak in the, we hope, the near future and start to wane?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I mean, we had the head of the Advent Healthcare Organization on Face the Nation Sunday morning, and he said he's expecting a peak later on this month. Well, later on this month, here we are July 14th, so we've got 17 more days. At least, and again, these numbers can change. The governor believes that the positivity rate is leveling out, but he also says, you know, that could change too. So the bottom line is there are an awful lot of moving parts right now, and I think, you know, anybody who tries to make predictions on this thing, you stand a good chance of that going south because there are so many wild cards.
The governor has been come in for some criticism on his handling of the situation. What's the current read there? I mean, are people getting fed up, or are they sticking with him mostly, or what's your sense?
Well, there was a heckler yesterday who interrupted him at his news conference, basically yelling, "You're not doing anything to help anybody." And you know, the governor has been mostly hands-off on a lot of things. He's left face mask rules up to local communities, counties, towns, cities. As far as schools go, yeah, there's an executive order to open up the schools for the fall session, which starts in just about a month. But again, bottom line is it's going to be up to the local communities. So, you know, there has been no real state mandate for anything except for stopping alcohol sales in bars a couple of weeks ago, because that's where so many of the cases stemmed from, people congregating in bars and not social distancing or wearing masks. But beyond that, you know, the only state action was when things were pretty much shut down back in March, and he didn't even lead the league in that one. Businesses and the theme parks here in Orlando started doing that on their own. So you can read into it what you'd like.
Now, speaking of theme parks, has Disney World reopened, or what's the story there?
Yeah, it reopened on Saturday and Sunday, and there were good crowds, but not interview with somebody who was inside the park yesterday, she just told us that, hey, there was a lot of social distancing and the safety rules were in place, and people felt, for the most part, very, very safe. We haven't heard anybody come out of the parks and say, oh, this was abysmal, but you do have health officials, not necessarily the official government people, who love the idea that the parks are reopening and starting to generate income down here, but you have other doctors who are saying you're just asking for fire, you're asking for trouble if you do this. And we had one who said it's like pouring gasoline on the fire right now.
I was surprised, frankly, to see, you know, it's just sort of the sort of, I don't know, motion to this thing is almost, it's all heading in one direction, but then here comes a big push in the other direction from an outfit like Disney World. I mean, it surprised me that on this week when we're reporting all these increases in numbers down there, that would be happening. But I guess, you know, they probably took some time to plan it and bring workers back and all that stuff. So it's hard to turn on a dime. But yikes.
Well, they absolutely did a lot of planning, and you know, the early reports are that they've done everything right now. Let's see what happens in another few weeks. And if we have more numbers spike and they're traced back to the theme parks. So far, we haven't had that happen with Universal or SeaWorld, and hopefully we don't have that happen with Disney. But you know something? When you're putting a lot of people in one place together, it can be tough. They're doing the smart thing and at least spacing people out, enforcing social distancing, enforcing the wearing of masks within the parks, and not letting you in if your temperature is over a certain threshold. So
yeah,
we'll see how that all goes.
Yeah, I had been working from home. I just showed up at my regular workplace for the first time this morning. They took my temperature, and it said 95, and I said, wow, I'm cool.
well, good for you. And you know something? I'll tell you something about, let's see, a month and a half ago when I went over to Kennedy Space Center to work out of our building to cover the SpaceX launch, before we go out on an assignment like that, we have to check in with a virtual nurse online and show her on a webcam the temperature reading from our thermometer to make sure that we are good to go.
Yep. Yeah, it's a strange world out there. Hey, I did want to focus one more question to you on school reopenings, because I know that in places like Florida, they actually typically open earlier in the summer than up here in the Northeast. And are schools reopening? And if so, are they doing so in classrooms or virtually or some combination thereof, or what's happening?
Well, that's a great question, and you really kind of nailed it. It's going to be a combination of all of the above. You know, I mentioned before that the governor has sent down orders on schools to reopen in time for the school year, which would be about the middle of next month. But school boards are meeting this week to finalize their plans and get them okayed by the state. And the bottom line is, if the school districts don't feel safe doing it, they're not going to do it. We've already had Miami-Dade, which is the fourth largest district in the country. We've already had them say, you know what, with everything going on down here right now, unless we see some kind of amazing improvement in the next month, classrooms are going to stay closed, and we're going to keep doing it online. Now, here in Orange County, in the Orlando area, you know, the rates are lower than Miami-Dade, but there is a great deal of concern, and a number of teachers have signed a petition that says, hey, we don't think it's safe enough to reopen today. They're debating all of this right now, and I think what you're going to see is with all the school districts around the state, it's going to be some kind of, you know, parents are going to have options. If they feel safe sending their kids back to a classroom, they'll be able to do that. If they don't, the kids will be able to learn at home. There are going to be some hybrids where maybe they go in a couple of days a week and maybe they learn on the computer at home the rest of the time. And like Miami-Dade, there may be some that just say, we're not opening classrooms yet. We're not ready.
Yeah, and what about school sports and other activities?
Well, I know that there have been some practices going on, but, you know, I think the feeling is if you can't have the students back, how can you really, really have them playing contact sports like football? And we really don't know where all that goes. And down here, I mean, the top five sports in Florida are all football. So that's a, you know, whether
football,
it's
football.
Yeah, just about college, professional, semi-pro, you name it. And high school, and you know, it'll be a hard nut to crack if there's no football here. But you know something, as I'm fond of saying, this is putting it really, really bluntly, you know, you can't play football if you're sick or dead.
That is very true, and you know, I got to say, even if they reopen schools, it seems like the sports will be one of the last things to get reconstituted, along with maybe band practice. I mean, who wants to be sitting in front of a trombone player blowing all those respiratory particles down the horn?
Well, yeah, technically we're already seeing what's happening with the colleges, and you know this from up in New England, that the Ivy League has already canceled its games.
Yep.
You've got a number of conferences who are saying they're only going to play conference games, and one athletic director I remember seeing, I think it's the Ohio State guy, who said, you know, it's really going to be a miracle of sorts if we do play this year. So,
yeah.
You know, there's just an awful lot, and you know, we all miss sports, we all want to see it come back, but we all want to see it come back safely.
That is for sure. Peter King of CBS News, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Always good talking with you.
Well, it's always good to be on with you, and thanks for having me on again.
Sure. Went on Facebook, and I said, hey, folks, give me some ideas for guests and topics you'd like to hear upcoming on the Dave Graham Show. And several people responded by saying, we want you to talk about the new food waste rules and law, which took effect July 1st of 2020, just a couple of weeks ago now. And To help us do that, we're going to be speaking with Josh Kelly from the Department of Environmental Conservation. Said he's been very busy lately, but is willing to give us some time this morning, which we much appreciate. Josh Kelly, I believe, is on the phone right now. Good morning, Josh. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
And why don't we just go back to the real basics here. Tell us what happened on July 1st regarding food waste.
Sure. July 1st was the last milestone of Vermont's universal recycling law to go into effect. This was known as Act 148 that was passed unanimously by the legislature in 2012. And at that time, the legislature had looked at Vermont's historic goals for waste, really looking at reducing our waste and recycling and composting 50% or more of our waste. It's been a goal for well over a decade, and Vermont hadn't been meeting it. And so they asked the agency and the department what was the materials that are most commonly found in our waste and how to go about keeping them out and treating them in a better way than just through landfilling. And recyclables and food waste were the major focus of that law. And the last piece was the ban on disposing of food scraps in the trash on July 1.
So, what happens if somebody violates the ban. Let's say he goes ahead and throws some eggshells into the trash that's going out to the landfill.
Right, right. We get that question all the time. And from the beginning, this has been a huge education and outreach process. I usually talk to people about how long we've been working at recycling, and as many people know, we still have work to do. Recycling is still sometimes disposed of in trash, and that was prohibited as of 2015. So our role and the department's role has been to ensure that there are services available for, like for collection for food waste, for collection of food waste at drop-off locations. And when the recycling law rolled out, same thing. Drop-off and curbside recycling was rolled out throughout the state. But we don't have staff that go out and inspect residents' trash bags. It's just not what we do. But we do check on complaints we receive and do follow up on the largest producers of food waste. So before the pandemic, we were doing outreach visits to supermarkets and food establishments to check on how they're doing with recycling and to talk to them about the upcoming food scrap requirements.
Let me roll the clock back for just a moment to this to the 2015 stage at which it was required that recycling not be included in regular trash. And certainly, I think most Vermonters have tried to follow that rule since then. But I think there's sometimes some confusion about, you know, what do I recycle? What can I still throw away? Here's one example. A lot of times you go and you buy a carton of orange juice or half and half for your coffee or something, and it's a wax paper carton, but it has this plastic spout on it, right? So you got different materials essentially in the same item. And you say to yourself, okay, I think one of these goes here and one of these goes there. Do you cut the little plastic spout out of the carton before you put it in your recycling and throw the plastic spout out? What do you actually do with that particular thing?
Yeah, it's a great question, Dave. And people have a lot of questions about recycling. And I honestly, it can be complicated, as you're noting. Cartons, the gable top cartons are not recyclable in Vermont. I'm not aware of anybody in Vermont that's able to recycle those. They are recyclable in other parts of the country, but not here in Vermont. They are made up of a multi-laminate of plastic film, wax paper, and then also plastic parts. And we just don't have strong markets for those materials in Vermont. So those should just be put in your household trash.
The whole carton.
And there are things. The whole carton,
yep, okay.
Just empty and put in the trash. And there's things like that that we don't have a good system for yet. And as you said, you know, recycling can be confusing. But I do want to stress that food waste is a little simpler. There's a lot of different types of food waste, but the composters around the state are able to process all food waste. So whether you use a drop-off or you use a curbside hauler, they take meat, bones, dairy products, meat and vegetables, all that stuff, and they can compost it, all year round. But if you're a home composter, the law actually allows you to dispose of meat and bones in the trash, even after July 1. And we want that to be clear, that nobody has to compost meat and bones if they're composting at home, and that includes fish. And further, that the law doesn't require you to compost at home. People have options. Like I said, there's drop-off locations. There's about 100 drop-offs around the state right now that offer food scrap collection.
Okay, and you can actually get curbside pickup, too, in some places, right?
In some places, yeah. We're seeing that growing. I was just talking with one of my colleagues at work, and we have a number of new food scrap haulers that have just registered, I think based on the demand that is out there for people looking for this service. We always encourage folks to ask their trash hauler if they offer the service. If you have a hauler that's offering trash, ask them if they offer a food scrap collection service. And that is starting to to pick up for sure.
The I wanted to just finish up with that question I asked a moment ago about cartons that have those plastic spouts on them and whether there's different waste streams for them and so on. And you're saying no, the whole thing goes in the trash. But I wanted to ask, if I have a question like that, I'm standing in my kitchen, I got one of these things in my hand, I just finished up the half and a half, and I go, what do I do with this thing now? Is there a place I could go online or whatever to find the answer to that question, or a number I could call, or just, you know, because these questions do come up in from time to time in relation to a lot of different items that you're going to end up holding in your hand and kind of wondering about?
Yeah. Yeah. It's an excellent question, Dave. And it's really the question of what do I do with this, right?
Yep.
What do I do with this thing? So the Department of Environmental Conservation in the solid waste program that I work in has a website. It's vtrecycles.com, vtrecycles.com. And at that website, we do have a what do I do with icon you can click, and you can learn all about different materials. And your local solid waste management entity, your town or your solid waste district, they do maintain A to Z waste and recycling guides. And that has a lot more detailed information about local recycling, everything from plastic bags or those air pillows that come in the shipping box you just got. If you can pop those plastic air pillows, many can be recycled at grocery stores in with the plastic bags. So the local solid waste district info, to find your district or your town, you can go to www.802recycles.com.
Okay. One of the things that I wonder about here, too, is, you know, an awful lot of American and, I guess, international companies are providing a whole range of different packaging out there. I mean, has anybody gone to the manufacturers of, and I just, I don't mean to pick on the on these cartons that your orange juice and half or milk come in, but, you know, the things with the plastic spouts, has anybody gone to these manufacturers and said, is there a form of packaging that you could provide or you could put your product in that would kind of fit better with our waste streams, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I do know what you mean. I mean, for people who've recycled for years, the things that they know are that aluminum is a valuable material. Mm-hmm. It's also an extremely lightweight material. When recycling markets got bad in the recent, actually 3-4 years now that they have been really poor, aluminum has generally maintained some of its value, and that helps the recycling markets for the other materials as well. And cardboard has had also a pretty good market. It has had its ups and downs, but those two things are just examples of very recyclable and commonly recyclable items that have some value. But glass is one that has less value. It's also heavy from packaging. And there are trade-offs in different types of materials that a product manufacturer might use. But I would say this, that product producers are very aware of their footprint that they have for their products they sell, whether it's shampoo or a soft drink, or whether it's a film pouch now for your tuna fish. They're very aware of their packaging and its life cycle, and they're looking at the best and most sustainable packaging in general, but it's not always recyclable, and that can be hard, and that's something that many manufacturers want. Companies like Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Unilever are starting to have voluntary standards for recycled content in some of their packaging. So you're seeing this awareness, especially around the ocean plastics issue, growing with producers and manufacturers about their packaging.
Yeah, that is a big concern. These, I guess, plastic islands that can form in the Pacific Ocean. I don't know if they're as prominent in the Atlantic, but that's just kind of it sounds like an environmental kind of a nightmare to some extent. And of course, there's been a lot of media coverage about that and that kind of thing. I wondered also in terms of the food scraps. We just have a couple of minutes to go before the break, but maybe we can get into this a little bit. Are the solid waste districts reporting and hardware stores and so on, is there a boom in sales of composting equipment out there?
Yes. Generally speaking, yes. I mean, we don't get reports of, we don't require reporting on that, but the anecdotal information we've been getting is yes, those sales have been up. And those sales have been up consistently because, again, the law went into effect in 2012, and there has been good media coverage around it at the different phases and milestones as the law phased in. And many people bought home composting bins early on just to get prepared. And some thought the law actually required it earlier than it did. But it's been great to see people getting buckets for their to use at their drop-off center, mm-hmm. kitchen countertop bins, as well as tumblers and home composting.
All right. We need to take a brief break here, as I mentioned, for our bottom of the hour news and a couple words from our sponsors. We're going to continue our conversation with Josh Kelly in just a couple of minutes here, folks. Before we do that, I wanted to mention that at just after 11 o'clock, the governor's news conference with other top state officials about the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis. They, of course, have, as I've mentioned previously, gone from three times a week to twice a week. It's Tuesdays and Fridays now. The governor's news conference is broadcast live here on WDEV, FM, and AM. And so stay tuned for that. But let's go to the break for right now. We'll be back shortly.
We're opening upstairs at the Warren store. Following CDC guidelines, we will allow three people at a time from 10 to 4 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and 11 to 3 Monday and Thursday until further notice. Or you can email Lori, L-O-R-I, at warrenstore.com to make an appointment. There's lots of great summer clothing at 50% off outside and new spring merchandise upstairs. Please wear a mask. We have disposables, and we will be selling organic wired ones from Product Think Tank. We'd love to see you. Stay safe. Main Street, Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
My guest is Josh Kelly. He's with the State Department of Environmental Conservation. And Josh, what is your official job title there? Can you refresh me on that?
Sure. I'm the Materials Management Section Chief. My section in the program covers the Universal Recycling Law as well as state solid waste planning for the agency.
I see. Okay. So I knew it was a fairly technical sounding job title. It's not,
yeah.
You're not just like solid waste guy or something like that. So
you can just call me that. That's good.
anyway, I wanted to circle back to the whole composting, the growth and popularity of composting. Because I am hearing a lot of interest out there. People just saying, I'm going to get a composter, or I'm going to switch from the pit full of garbage in the back on the back 40 to an actual official composter of some kind. But a lot of interest in composting, and there's got to be places people can go to kind of learn how to do it properly, because you could do it badly. And actually, I've heard from Lewis Porter, the commissioner of Fish and Wildlife, or one of your sister agencies, departments there in the Agency of Natural Resources, who has said that, you know, there are actual laws governing with how you're supposed to do compost, and not doing that. Can that bring a fine or something, or what's the deal there?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Lewis Porter, Commissioner Porter, and Fish and Wildlife, because improper composting, as we all know, can attract critters. And most concerning probably is bears, with many of the bear concerns that have been shared most recently. I think what I've been working with Forrest Hammond and their department for about 3 years now on this issue. And so we have tried to make our messaging synonymous with Fish and Wildlife about bear management, and really encouraging people to compost with confidence. Having a enclosed bin is number one. And the faster that you compost food waste, the less it's going to attract any type of animal, because it becomes soil and it's no longer a food source. And that is all about mixing the carbon materials, the brown materials, with the green materials, and about three parts browns to one part food waste. So leaves is really common that people use, dry leaves, dead leaves, especially in fall. But wood shavings is excellent. Even newspaper shredded up can work really well.
So you want some of that sort of drier material, and generally it is drier unless you have wet leaves, I guess, but to mix in, and it's a 3-to-1 ratio in terms of three parts yard waste, basically, to one part eggshells, kitchen waste.
Yes, exactly. And to your other question, I mean, if people are improperly composting, and we occasionally get those complaints, and I'm sure Fish and Wildlife has as well, we do not encourage them to continue. They should stop doing it that way. And first and foremost, no one should be composting at risk of their health in regard to bears and bear activity. I think they should be, the drop-off locations have become super convenient in Vermont, in many parts of Vermont, and they allow you to take all your food waste there. And actually, bears have been an issue with trash cans as well, strewing trash around on early mornings on streets and roads, and nobody likes that either. So
right.
Really trying to, and we find that bird feeders are like the gateway for bears to be coming into yards.
Mm-hmm.
With many people home, there's an assumption that maybe people are feeding birds more because they're in their home office or they're hanging out at home and they have the bird feeders still up, and they really should be coming down and coming down very soon in the spring.
Yeah. So what times a year should people have bird feeders up?
I think I've heard that, really just those winter months and really following the bear hibernation cycles. And I don't know those as well as my colleagues over in Fish and Wildlife, but I know they have guidance on that.
Yeah.
Their website. So that's where I direct people.
Got it. But this time of year, obviously, if you leave bird feeders out, you're going to be it's an invitation to bears, and you don't want you don't want bears pestering you. They should be uphill usually in the deeper woods and stay out of our residential neighborhoods. That's just that is a real situation that folks are trying to avoid. I wanted to also ask you about the in terms of the proper design or when you decide I'm going to build a composter, are there websites you can go to sort of find out how to do it, or what are the options out there if you just want to go over to the garden center and buy a composter, that kind of thing?
Yeah, the most common offerings for composters are either for sale through your hardware store, your garden center, or through your solid waste district or town. Many of them offer discounted or at-cost food scrap composting bins. And they range from the sort of solar digester type, where you're not using it for to get compost out of it. You're just putting it into one of the products is called the green cone.
Yeah.
It's typically buried in flower gardens. And you put your food waste into there, and it is decomposed by the soil bacteria, and they do eventually can fill up if they get heavy use, but if they're used fairly infrequently or just mainly in the summertime, they're pretty effective.
Mm-hmm.
The other types are barrel turners, or the soil saver is a very common sort of square plastic composter. We have guidance on our website at btrecycles.com on how to install a soil saver with a galvanized wire mesh. It's called hardware cloth bottom to protect from critters. I've had people tell me the woodchuck keeps crawling under the bin, and the way to prevent that is with this galvanized wire mesh.
Yep.
And so there's a lot of different options, and they have their different advantages and disadvantages. The bottom line is, If you use a composting service, a food scrap collection service, or you bring your food scrap bucket to a transfer station, there may be a cost to you to do that, but you're having somebody else take over the work to manage your food waste. If you manage it at home, you may save money, but you really should be putting the time in to manage it well, and that's all about having good carbon materials to add to it.
Right, And I guess the other upside to having your own home compost is that you can actually then extract some, you hope, soil, nice rich compost soil from the bottom of it every now and then, and then have something to put in your garden to help your next year's vegetables grow, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been using this time at home working remotely to build a couple of raised beds and try my hand at using my home compost. Traditionally, I just spread it around trees and shrubs and flower beds,
mm-hmm.
but now I'm using it on my vegetable garden, and I did find that it's working pretty well. But it's about putting that work into it, and you'll get something out of it. I do tell people that often your home compost doesn't look the same as store-bought compost. Store-bought compost is screened to take out the bigger chunks. And so at home compost, if you had put in bark mulch in there or little sticks and twigs, which are actually pretty good for your compost, they often are not fully broken down later on, which is actually perfectly okay. People like Charlie Nardozzi and gardeners know that diversity in a garden in the soil is good for a natural functioning soil ecosystem. But you're right. If you compost at home and you compost well, you eventually will have some compost to use for yourself.
Yeah, and I remember, I had another question about green cones, because green cones can tend to fill up, and then people sort of say, well, what do I do now? And the... and the answer maybe go out to your green cone less often and go ahead and put some of the, especially the meat waste, the bones and gristle, et cetera, can still go in the trash, right?
Yes, correct. And some people who are avid composters use two types of systems. They use maybe a barrel turner or a green cone in the summer. And then in the winter, they might use a drop-off. Or they might use an on-the-ground soil saver type composter. The ones I find that are on the ground work. Everything freezes in the winter. First of all, your food waste does freeze in the winter if you're home composting. But if you continue to add browns, or you at least save your browns up until roughly March and start to add them in March and turn and stir your mix your compost up, then you can return it to active composting again, usually by late March, early April. And that's a key time when you need to really be actively composting, because you have this frozen, food waste that has just been frozen through January and February. So that's what I do at my house. But many people have two different types of systems, one for the warmer months and one for the colder months.
Let's go to a listener who's calling in, Michelle from Plainfield. Good morning, Michelle.
Hi. So in Cambridge, Mass., where they've done mandatory recycling, they give people a little green, like, bin, like a sort of miniature of the bins you have for other garbage, and you can put it in there in little compostable bags, and the city picks it up. And I'm wondering if Vermont has ever thought about doing something like that or offering that. I don't know if that's clear what I said.
Josh, city pickup of compost. Does anybody do we have any municipalities in Vermont
or private ones like Casella or something?
Well, that's a good point too. I suppose they could certainly offer that. What are the curbside pickups? I know there are some available. What are they looking like now?
Sure. In terms of city involvement in curbside pickup, the one that I know of the best is Brattleboro. And they offer curbside trash recycling and food scrap compostable collection from their residents. And they've been doing that, I think they've been doing that as much as 4 or 5 years now with great success. They actually keep 60% of their waste is recycled or composted. So they're well above the state goal already. And that's consistent with what we find, that 20% or more of food waste is food and food waste. And now that's not required that towns offer that service. It's much more common for towns in the southern New England states to have a contracted trash hauler that services their community residents. Vermont tends to be more of a private subscription service. So for the private food scrap haulers out there, I'm aware that we have a list at our website, vtrecycles.com, of food scrap haulers. Most of them are commercial, but many of them are starting to offer residential services. In the Chittenden County area, I know they have probably three residential food scrap haulers, and in central Vermont, I think we have two. So and there's more growing. There's some up in St. Albans that are residential based. There are more in Addison County now. And there's some also, as I mentioned, down in the Windham area in Brattleboro.
Okay, thanks.
So certainly growing.
Michelle, I'm just wondering, are you a home composter now and you're thinking about maybe I'd let you go curbside? Or do we have no more? I guess Michelle rung off. Thanks for the call, Michelle. Let's see here. Josh Kelly, about the commercial haulers, are people finding that to be a viable business? Or are they actually making a living at going around picking up compost and then doing what with it? Bringing it to a compost company, or how's it all work?
Yeah, many of them bring it to composting facilities. There's about a dozen or more of those facilities around the state currently.
Mm-hmm.
And before the law even went into effect, there were food scrap haulers, some of which were residential, but most were commercial. And since the law began in 2012, there's been nearly a doubling, and probably easily a doubling now, because I think we just had 5+ food scrap haulers start up. So before the law, it was viable, and after the law, it's certainly even more viable. But I think it just depends. You have to build out a route, and you need to do that in a way that you can support a business. So the more rural areas are places that have less services, for sure. But some of those areas are even changing, too, and many of them have a good drop-off option for managing food waste. So.
And I'm wondering in terms of the companies that are sort of more centralized composters. I mean, in some ways, it makes sense that they would be the place that there's almost a preference for that versus home composting, because home composting, obviously, as you say, unless you're willing to put in the time and it is some work, et cetera, and you really have to sort of care about what you're doing. It's not just a matter of, throwing your garbage in a box and hoping for the best. You have to think about, the ratios of brown to green, and et cetera, and different times of year and how active they are and all of this kind of consideration. Whereas if somebody comes by your house and picks up your food scraps, to take them to a composting center, the people who work at the composting center, that's what they do for work, and they're going to be, taking a very organized approach to using your food scraps to make compost. Whereas it could be a little more haphazard.
And Dave, I think we're really lucky in Vermont to be able to have these different options.
Mm-hmm.
And you really don't have to take my word for it. We have a website we launched around the July 1st date called Let's Scrap Food Waste. It's scrapfoodwaste.org. And there's a video, an advertisement that we have running. There actually even have been radio ads that were also placed consistent with this new law change. But on that website, the scrapfoodwaste.org website, there are testimonials, the scrapbook we call it, of people who are either bringing their food scraps to a drop-off, they have a curbside service, maybe they're a backyard composter. And it really, you can see in their experiences how they do it, how they manage it. And many of them, it's second nature. It's not hard. It's not difficult. So I want to give the false impression that this is really hard work. I think for people who do this day in, day out, it's not hard work, and they get a benefit out of it. They
mm-hmm.
save money. They're able to use compost at their house. And probably most important of all, it brings their awareness to the fact that food is a resource that should not be wasted, and that wasting food costs us more money than anything. It's estimated the average American family of four wastes $1,500 a year on food they bought and never ate. So we really stress eat what you buy and compost the scraps. And that's what this initiative is all about.
Yeah, that is kind of drives me crazy when I dig into the refrigerator and I find something in there that we bought a couple weeks ago, and it's kind of gone past any edibility at this point. And you go, that was a waste. What are we doing here? Come on. I'm sure that is not an experience unique to my household, though. And so A couple stages you've mentioned. One was that you're not supposed to put recyclable stuff in the trash, effective in 2015. Now effective this July 1st, just a couple of weeks ago, not supposed to put food scraps in the trash. There are other ways to manage the food scraps, and certainly we've been talking about composting and pick and services that'll pick up your food scrap and places you can take your food scrap. And by the way, if that third option is the one that you want to try, I gather that's on your website too, a list of places you can take your food scraps?
Yes. If you go to vtrecycles.com, there is a find a facility link right at the top. It's a little teardrop shape, and it basically uploads a map that's very similar to like MapQuest or Google Maps, where you can find facilities and what they offer. If you know of the transfer stations around you, all transfer stations that collect trash were required to offer food scrap collection in 2017, and we worked with many of them to get ready back then. And I wanted to mention, Dave,
sure.
I've talked about that food waste makes up a significant portion of our waste stream. It's the single largest part of it, at about 20%. But I didn't talk about, well, why should we care? And people often say to me, well, doesn't my food waste, you know, it decomposes the landfill. It rots the landfill. You know, it helps other things break down, right? Doesn't that, isn't that how it works?
Yep.
And I want to just be clear on what a landfill is and isn't. A landfill is kind of like a burial of our waste. It's kind of like a mummification of waste. It's not meant as a process or a management structure other than to just contain it. It has a plastic liner on the bottom and a plastic liner on the top when it's closed, when they close what's called a cell, which is typically about the size of a soccer field. And so there are varying different things happen in a landfill. Sometimes there's decomposition, and sometimes there's very little decomposition. There have been newspapers pulled out from the 1950s in landfills that are as easy to read as the day they were printed.
Wow.
There's been a package of carrots pulled out that other than being black on the outside, once cracked open, they're still orange on the inside. So it's kind of like a mummification for waste. And when food waste in particular breaks down very slowly in that landfill, it releases methane gas. And that is a very potent greenhouse gas. So really two reasons why food waste in a landfill is not a good idea. One, it doesn't even need to be there in the first place, taking up space. We have composting facilities at former landfill sites, and that's actually something I think will be more common in the future. There's one in Brattleboro at a former landfill. There's one in Heartland at a landfill that was permitted but not built. That's in the Heartland is just south of White River Junction.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one in Bennington, right near the former landfill site there. So this is sort of the way food waste can be managed, either through composting, anaerobic digestion, or even animal feed. And then secondly, that that food waste, besides taking up space, it does produce that methane. And methane is captured in many landfills, and Vermont's major landfill does have methane capture, but they're not able to capture all of it. And methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, 25 times or more as damaging and as potent as carbon dioxide. And when we run the calculations, like if Vermonters were composting their food scraps and not disposing of them in the landfill, it would be the same as taking over 9,500 cars off the road each year.
Wow.
It's a significant greenhouse gas reducing step to be keeping food waste out of the landfill.
I was not aware of that. I'm glad you added that, because that's clearly an important way to think about this as well. So excellent work there getting the word out, Josh. I appreciate it. Josh Kelly's been my guest. He is with the Department of Environmental Conservation. He's the Materials Management Section Chief there. Josh, thank you very much for joining me. I really appreciate talking with you, and perhaps we can touch base again in the future, not too distant future, to just check in on how all this is going in Vermont's new world of composting food scraps. And thanks again.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks, Dave.
All righty. Hey, we are fast approaching the top of the hour, which means we're going to hand off the baton here at WDEV, FM, and AM, and going live shortly after the CBS News at the top of the hour for another news conference with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials about the COVID-19 crisis. Stay with WDEV. I'll be back tomorrow morning with another edition of our program. Meanwhile, stay healthy, everybody. We'll talk to you soon.